This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
وَهُوَ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is his. Who is he that can intercede with him but by his permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of his knowledge except what he pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and he is the Most High, the Great.
U.S. President Donald Trump says he will leave the White House if the Electoral College confirms Joe Biden as the winner of the November 3rd vote. Australia's army orders the dismissal of 13 soldiers in connection with the unlawful killing of civilians and inmates in Afghanistan. Also ahead, Germany says its total number of coronavirus infections has passed 1 million as the country struggles to contain the spread of the disease. Thank you very much for joining us. We're starting off in the U.S. this hour. U.S. President Donald Trump says he will leave the White House if the Electoral College votes for his rival, Joe Biden, to be the winner of the disputed election.
So if the Electoral College does elect President-elect Joe Biden, are you not going to leave this building?
Certainly I will. And you know that. But I think that there will be a lot of things happening between now and the 20th. Of January, a lot of things.
He made the comments after a Thanksgiving Day address to U.S. troops at the White House. This was the closest the U.S. president has come to conceding defeat in the November 3rd election. U.S. media declared Biden the winner of the election after projecting that he will receive 270 electoral votes required to enter the Oval Office. Trump and some of his fellow Republicans claim that the vote was rigged in favor of Biden and have filed several lawsuits to overrule the election results. The Electoral College is due to vote on December 14th to officially decide the outcome of the presidential election. Elsewhere, the Australian Army says 13 soldiers could face dismissal in relation to a damning report on alleged war crimes in Afghanistan.
At this time, 13 individuals have been issued administrative action notices in relation to the Afghanistan inquiry. At this point in time, no individuals have been separated from the Australian Defence Force. Administrative action includes receiving a notice proposing to terminate the individual's service. The individual then has the opportunity to respond within a minimum of 14 days. The decision maker must be today.
The Australian Army Chief said each matter and individual circumstance will be considered on a case-by-case basis. The move to discharge the soldiers follows a last week report on a years-long investigation. It said Australia's elite special forces unlawfully killed 39 Afghan civilians and prisoners. The victims included those killed by summary execution. The report recommended 19 individuals be referred to Australian Federal Police. It's also recommended that compensation is paid to the families of the victims. Canberra apologised to Kabul over the alleged war crimes. Now, the alleged war crimes by the Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan have caused outrage there. People and rights groups have demanded perpetrators be brought to justice. Amin Alami in Kabul has also asked locals about the issue. Let's take a listen to what the Afghans had to say.
Not only Australian forces, but others will kill us if we continue to ignore each other's will. This is clear that they provided some specific figures with dollars and heavy vehicles while our people are trampled.
It's quite clear that the responsible Australian forces must be prosecuted, and their prosecution process must be widely covered by media outlets to advocate victims' rights.
We want the ICC as a responsible body in this regard to seriously investigate the killing of civilians by Australian forces and punish them.
Killing of civilians is not in line with no law and logic. So the government and international body need to strongly back the rights of the victims and bring the accountable figures to justice.
Those Australian forces who have killed innocent civilians in Oruzgan must be punished. They have claimed to support us, instead they kill us. So the government and international rights bodies must properly investigate the case.
Elsewhere, the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees announces that it is hit by an unprecedented financial crisis.
For the first time in the history of the agency, we have no cash available anymore to cover our spending between now and the end of the year.
Philippe Lazzarini, the Commissioner General of UNRWA, says the agency has received the lowest level of contributions since 2012. This is while the coronavirus pandemic is exacerbating the needs of the refugees. The agency relies on funds from UN member states and the European Union, but its finances have been ravaged by a US decision to slash hundreds of millions of dollars of aid. Lazzarini also warns that the health system in Gaza is about to collapse due to the coronavirus pandemic. Gaza, which has been under an Israeli enforced blockade since 2007, is experiencing a deteriorating economic situation. Political commentator Zafra Bangesh says U.S. projected winner by media count Joe Biden is unlikely to help UNRWA deal with its severe financial crisis, as he has proven to be a believing Zionist.
The Palestinians are now basically being abandoned, and they are being told that unless and until they accept the demands that the Trump regime had imposed, as well as the Netanyahu regime had imposed, that unless and until these Palestinians accept those demands, that they are going to be abandoned completely and they are going to starve in the refugee camps. So this is the stark situation that the Palestinian people face at the present time. And so what Joe Biden is going to do, we really don't know. I think we shouldn't hold too much hope, because Joe Biden is on record as stating that he is a Zionist, and he had said that if Israel did not exist, that America would have had to invent it or create it. So I think it would be unrealistic to hold too much hope that Joe Biden is going to take any steps that is somehow going to, he's going to do something that would benefit or help the Palestinian people.
Meanwhile, a new UN report says the cumulative economic cost of the Israeli occupation only from the prolonged closure and military operations in Gaza during the 2007 to 2018 period is estimated at $16.7 billion. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
The UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, said in a report that Israel's prolonged blockade of the Gaza Strip and the regime's military operations against the Palestinian enclave had inflicted some $17 billion in losses between 2007 and 2018. Richard Guzel-Wright, the director of UNCTAD's Globalization and Development Strategy, said that it was extremely difficult to see anything but redevelopment being the fate of Gaza society. The Israeli regime has placed the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade since 2007 and waged three wars on it since 2008. The blockade and military operations had driven the poverty rate in Gaza to increase almost fourfold compared with normal conditions.
The losses that were highlighted in the UNCTAD report show the extent of damage caused by the Israeli blockade and wars against the Gaza Strip, especially the three major wars since 2008. Israel has systematically destroyed civilian infrastructure and economic sectors, in addition to the loss of innocent lives.
According to the UNCTAD report, Gaza has witnessed one of the worst economic performances globally. In addition to killing and maiming thousands of Gazans during the wars, Israeli forces also bombed civilian infrastructure, as well as thousands of factories and businesses.
The Palestinian economy in Gaza is collapsing because of the Israeli wars and blockade. Israel waged three major wars in less than 10 years and destroyed all aspects of our economy in Gaza.
As day laborers, we sustained heavy losses because of the wars. Factories were destroyed during the wars, and thousands of people lost their sources of income.
UNCTAD says its estimates are partial because they cover only the economic cost of the Israeli occupation, from the prolonged closure and recurrent military operations in Gaza from 2007 to 2018. Experts say the Israeli regime must be held accountable for its illegal policies against the Palestinian people.
Israeli military aggressions and the blockade amount to war crimes, and the international community must bring an end to Israel's impunity. The Palestinian Authority and human rights organizations must also include the economic file in their complaints at the International Criminal Court because Israel perpetrated war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Observers say that for Gaza's economy to slightly recover, the blockade must be fully lifted. According to UN figures, the Israeli regime is responsible for the near collapse of Gaza's regional economy and its isolation from the Palestinian economy and the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Now, elsewhere, Germany's total confirmed coronavirus infections has passed 1 million as the country is struggling to curb the second wave of the outbreak. Cases jumped after the Robert Koch Institute on Friday reported more than 22,000 new infections. Germany has been reporting hundreds of daily deaths in the past few days. Its total COVID fatalities are now nearing 15,600. The virus has been surging despite a partial lockdown in place since the beginning of November. The German government now says the lockdown will be extended through January. Chancellor Angela Merkel has said that the measures will ease only if a dramatic drop occurs in the number of infections. The British drug maker AstraZeneca plans to run an additional global trial to assess its COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness. The company's chief executive, Pascal Soriot, says studies show the efficacy of the lowered dosage of the vaccine is more than the full dosage and more study is required to validate it. He noted that the international trial will be faster and needs fewer patients. AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine's effectiveness is questioned as many experts doubt the test trials were scientifically valid. Several scientists raised doubts as the company previously claimed its experimental vaccine was 90% effective in a subgroup of patients who were mistakenly given a half dose rather than a full dose. Experts say this could reduce the vaccine's chances of getting a quick regulatory approval from the US and the EU. Three French police officers have been suspended after they were filmed beating and allegedly racially abusing a black man in Paris. That's according to France's police watchdog. The watchdog says an official inquiry is also underway into the officer's behavior. The victim is a music producer. He said he had been walking around without a face mask and walked into a studio. However, the police followed him inside and physically attacked him using tear gas. The case comes as anger is boiling in France over a new security law approved on Tuesday. The law places restrictions on identifying police officers involved in operations. Critics say the legislation could allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished. In other news, Sudan's former prime minister and top opposition figure Sadiq al-Mehdi died on Thursday after weeks of struggle with COVID-19. Al-Mehdi was the country's last democratically elected prime minister and a staunch opposition to normalization of ties with Israel.
Sudan's former premier Sadiq al-Mahdi dies from the novel coronavirus at the age of 84. Al-Mahdi was Sudan's last democratically elected prime minister, who was transferred to the United Arab Emirates for treatment but succumbed to the illness nonetheless. The government declared 3 days of national mourning for his passing. Al-Mahdi was born in 1935 in the city of Omdurman and grew up during the last two decades of British imperial rule on Sudan. He became the country's prime minister in 1966, but his term did not last long as he was ousted in 1967 by a coalition of defectors. Later in 1986, Al-Mahdi was elected again as premier, but was toppled once more in 1989 by former ruler Omar al-Bashir in a military coup. The post of prime minister of Sudan was then abolished. Since his ouster, al-Mahdi continued to lead the Ummah Party, one of the largest opposition movements during Bashir's era, and spent a period in exile, but eventually returned to Sudan in the year 2000. He threw his weight behind the mass protest movement that eventually prompted the military to overthrow the president last year. After Bashir's ouster, al-Mahdi pushed for a transfer to civilian rule, warning of the risks of a counter-coup and calling for the powerful paramilitary rapid support forces to be integrated into the army. Al-Mahdi was also against the normalization of ties with Israel and supported the axis of resistance against the regime. In October, he slammed US President Donald Trump's announcement that Sudan would start normalizing ties with Israel. Al-Mahdi stressed that Trump's statement contradicts the Sudanese national law and contributes to the elimination of the peace process in the Middle East. He accused Trump of being racist against Muslims and described Israel as an apartheid regime. However, Sudan became the third Arab country to normalize ties with Israel after the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in August. Al-Mahdi warned that normalizing ties with Tel Aviv will prepare the ground for the ignition of a new war.
The footballing world is in mourning after the passing of Diego Maradona, a true legend of the game. But as Murtaza Jaffa reports, this international icon was bigger than football and leaves a lasting legacy across the globe.
World superstar Diego Armando Maradona has died after suffering a heart attack at his home in the suburbs of Buenos Aires, Argentina. At just 60 years of age, the footballing icon has shocked the world for one last time. As news broke, mourners gathered across the world to pay their respects. Tributes poured in as the sense of loss was palpable across the globe. Argentine President Alberto Fernandez declared 3 days of national mourning. In Napoli, Italy, fans gathered outside the city's San Paolo Stadium, where Maradona captained the club's most successful period. As a tribute, the club will rename their stadium in honour of him. Champions League matches throughout Europe held a minute's silence for the superstar, who is held as one of the best, if not the best, to have ever played the game. But like very few, Maradona transcended his sport. He was a global icon loved by the people, the media couldn't get enough and followed him everywhere. Much was made of his life outside of football, as the icon struggled with addiction, but for many, that was part of his appeal. He was real and not a carefully choreographed PR exercise. He was a flawed footballing genius who managed to capture the imagination of the world. Despite his stature, his personality was enormous. He famously said, "I am Maradona, who makes goals, who makes mistakes. I can take it all. I have shoulders big enough to fight with everybody." This fighting spirit shone through in the man's politics. While the mainstream media will focus on his footballing abilities, human rights campaigners across the world know they have lost a true advocate for social justice, a staunch anti-imperialist who used his platform to challenge global powers. He ardently campaigned against the Iraq War and condemned global powers destroying Syria. In 1986, when the icon scored the infamous Hand of God against England, he said it was symbolic revenge for Britain's Falklands War against his country. When it came to the Palestinian cause, he proudly wore his support. The footballing icon was a great advocate of socialist leaders in South America and was great friends with Cuban revolutionary leader Fidel Castro. He famously described him as his second father. As fate would have it, Maradona would pass away on the same day as his revolutionary friend, only 4 years apart. The shock across the world is still raw. For many, the icon passed on far too young, but Diego Armando Maradona lived his life to the fullest. He was a small man, but stood head and shoulders above all on the football pitch and inspired millions off of it. He'll be remembered as one of the greatest ever.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Supplication on Fridays.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
A climate model released by the prestigious scientific publisher Springer Nature offers a roadmap for meeting and surpassing the targets set by the Paris Climate Agreement, showing that we can solve the global climate crisis with currently available technologies and natural climate solutions. The book, titled Achieving the Paris Climate Agreement, was the culmination of a two-year collaboration with 17 leading scientists at the University of Technology, Sydney, two institutes at the German Aerospace Centre, DLR, and the University of Melbourne's Climate and Energy College. Stay with us for an article penned by the staff writers of OneEarth.com website, published under the heading Below 1.5 degrees Celsius, a breakthrough roadmap to solve the climate crisis. Stay with us. A As the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, warned in its special report on global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius, released October 2018, the Earth must be kept below the dangerous threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius in global average temperature rise, above pre-industrial levels, if we are to avoid a worsening of climate-related impacts. We are already seeing the devastating consequences of the current 1 degree C global temperature increase, including rising sea levels in many coastal cities, extreme storms, prolonged droughts, and intensified wildfires. The impacts resulting from higher temperatures are almost unimaginable. The death of the coral reefs in every ocean, the collapse of nearly one quarter of the world's agricultural land, dramatically increased heat waves and wildfires. 100 million people driven to extreme poverty, sparking multiple refugee crises. 1 meter of sea level rise in some regions, and more than $11 trillion per year in damages from extreme storm and flooding. Stacked upon each other, these impacts and many more could undermine the very fabric of life on our planet, greatly challenging the continuation of human civilization as we currently know it. Up until now, it was assumed to be difficult, if not impossible, to achieve the carbon budget required to stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius rise, a maximum of 400 billion tons of cumulative carbon dioxide emissions from January 2018 onwards. Humans today release approximately 39 cumulative carbon dioxide emissions per year, mostly from burning of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. At other current level of emissions, we would only have 7 years to completely cease the use of all fossil fuels, which is clearly not feasible. While many scientists have modeled 1.5 degrees Celsius climate mitigation pathways to make the math work, almost all of them require the use of unproven and potentially dangerous geoengineering strategies like solar radiation management or bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. The 1.5 degrees Celsius climate model is groundbreaking in that it shows the 1.5 degrees Celsius target can be achieved through a rapid transition to 100% renewable energy by 2050, 56% by 2030. Alongside a major conservation effort to increase the resilience of natural ecosystems and help ensure greater food security. This includes a moratorium on land conversions by 2030 and 400 cumulative carbon dioxide emissions of negative emissions from forest and land restoration, which pulls carbon dioxide out of atmosphere and stores it in trees and soil. Co-author and editor, Dr. Sven Teske, a research director of the Institute for Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology at Sydney, Australia, said, "Scientists cannot fully predict the future, but advanced modeling allows us to map the best scenarios for creating a global energy system fit for the 21st century. And with momentum around the Paris Climate Agreement lagging, it's crucial that decision makers around the world can see that we can, in fact, meet global energy demand at a lower cost with clean, renewable energy. Some have doubted that a transition to 100% renewable energy is even possible. To explore the potential, the scientists created a sophisticated computer model of the world's electrical grids to date, with 10 regional and 72 sub-regional energy grids modeled in hourly increments to the year 2050. Along with a comprehensive assessment of available renewable resources like wind and solar energy, minerals required for manufacturing of components, and configurations for meeting projected energy demand and storage most efficiently for all sectors over the next 30 years. The result of the modeling effort shows that not only is it possible to switch to 100% renewable energy for all energy users, but it will cost much less to operate than today's energy system. Moreover, it will eliminate the toxic pollution associated with the burning of fossil fuels, estimated to be a primary cause of 9 million premature deaths per year. The renewable energy transition will not only improve public health worldwide, it will also drive economic development, providing the 30 million people currently working in the energy sector with permanent, well-paying jobs and creating an additional 12 million new jobs. The proposed energy transition outlined in the 1.5 degrees Celsius climate model will require investment globally of approximately $1.7 trillion per year. This sounds like a lot of money, but it pales in comparison to the vast subsidies governments currently provide to prop up the ailing fossil fuel industry, estimated at more than $4.7 trillion per year by the International Monetary Fund, IMF. Taxpayers are unwittingly funding the climate crisis, and that needs to stop. The research tells us that we could be creating the clean energy future we so desperately need for the less than one-third of what we're spending now, and in so doing, improve energy access in the developing world. There are five major components to the renewable energy transition. First is increased capacity to generate electricity, mostly through solar and wind power, enabling the electrification of all energy users, including power, heating, transportation, and even industrial users. Second is increased storage capacity in the form of battery arrays and pumped hydroelectric, which uses excess generation of pumped water up to a reservoir, releasing the energy when needed. Third is energy efficiency, decreasing overall energy consumption, especially in the developed world, by making buildings, cities, and vehicles more efficient. Fourth involves repurposing the existing gas pipeline and storage infrastructure to deliver hydrogen produced by renewable sources. A fifth is a gradual retraining of the energy workforce to participate in the burgeoning green economy. The sixth major component of the climate model is land restoration. Malte Mainshausen, co-author, founding director of the Climate and Energy College at the University of Melbourne in Australia, says, citing a growing body of research, we show that using land restoration efforts to meet negative emission requirements, along with the transition to 100% renewable energy by 2050, gives the world a good chance of staying below the 1.5 degrees Celsius target. Natural climate solutions, including everything from restoring natural forests, grasslands and wetlands, to improving soil fertility through regenerative agricultural practices like agroforestry, silvopasture and cover crops. These solutions not only absorb carbon, they also dramatically increase sustainable livelihoods in the developing world, offering improved water supplies, reduced soil erosion, and higher quality of crop yields. The 1.5 degrees Celsius model shows just how important our natural ecosystems are. Carl Burkhardt, managing director of One Earth, says, "Nature is the missing key. While the renewable energy transition is imperative to solving the climate crisis, it isn't enough. Currently, wildlands and oceans absorb one-half of all our carbon dioxide emissions. As this climate model shows, in order to keep global temperature rise to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, we have to keep our natural carbon sinks intact, scale up restoration efforts, and shift to regenerative agriculture. Without them, we have no future." The land use sector should be a big part of the climate solution. Unfortunately, because of rampant deforestation and unsustainable industrial agriculture and livestock practices, it is a net emitter of greenhouse gas pollution. Many efforts like the New York Declaration on Forests is working to halt deforestation by 2030, and United Nations Sustainable Development Goals 15 calls ending up to this destructive practice. The climate model shows that by protecting natural ecosystems and completely phasing out deforestation in the 2030s, we can maintain the integrity of the carbon sinks, and those sinks that are so vital to rebalancing our global climate system. The newly released climate model is part of the larger One Earth initiative, which builds upon the latest science to create a vision for the world that is possible in 2050. A world in which humanity and nature can coexist and thrive together. The vision is based upon three pillars of action: 100% renewable energy, the protection and restoration of 50% of the world's lands and oceans, and a transition to regenerative agriculture. Together, these pillars of action give us a global roadmap to tackle the climate crisis and to ensure a sustainable future for all of Earth's inhabitants. After 20 years of negotiations, the world governments came together under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, and established the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. They created a structure in which countries could submit pledges called Nationally Determined Commitments, or NDCs, that would be added together to achieve the target of staying well below 2 degrees Celsius in global average temperature rise, with the goal of gradually increasing commitments over time. While the Paris Climate Accord was a success in many ways, it's very clear that it will not deliver what is needed to achieve reductions sufficient to avoid a climate crisis. The latest analysis of government commitments by Climate Action Tracker estimates the current pledges would result in about 2.85 degrees Celsius of global temperature rise. There is hope, however, in the next commitment period that pledges will increase as the world wakes up to the disastrous impact of our current level of global warming. It's clear that all three pillars of action are required to achieve the goal of limiting warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. A transition to 100% renewable energy by 2050, whilst incredibly aggressive, is not sufficient to get to a lower 50% likelihood of the target, much less a strong 67% likelihood. Environmental conservation, which avoids approximately 100 GT CO2 emissions from land use, change relative to the reference case, plus 275 GT CO2 in negative emissions from environmental restoration gets us very close to that goal, but it takes an additional 25 GT CO2 in negative emissions from the agricultural sector to actually get to a strong likelihood of staying below 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in average temperatures.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestinian miners have suffered illegal Israeli incarceration since the start of 2020. The occupation forces continue to target young Palestinians across the occupied territories, with approximately 170 Palestinian children currently suffering behind bars. Palestinian miners from East Jerusalem get pulled out of bed in the middle of the night, needlessly handcuffed, and then made to spend a long time waiting for their interrogation to begin. Only when they are tired and broken are they taken in for lengthy interrogation sessions without being given the opportunity to speak to a lawyer or their parents before the questioning begins, and without understanding that they have the right to remain silent. They are then held in detention facilities under harsh conditions for days and weeks. In some cases, all this is attended by threats, verbal and physical abuse before and during the interrogation. Without the protection of their parents or even adults that they can trust, and in complete disregard for their youth, the boys have to endure this entire process alone, far from their families, away from their normal daily routine and anything familiar. No one explains to them where they are being taken, what they are suspected of, what their rights are, who they may confer with, how long the process will take, and when they will return to their families and homes. These practices have Israeli occupation forces free to use pressure to force them to confess. And indeed, many of the detained minors sign involuntary confessions of crimes they never did, which are then used as the basis for indictments against them. All for what? Well, this aspect of life in East Jerusalem cannot be separated from Israel's overall policy in the city. All Israeli occupation forces operating in East Jerusalem follow a policy aimed at encouraging Palestinian residents to leave the city. What better way to terrorize the public than by using their own children as bait? Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The use of force, nighttime arrests, questioning not in the presence of their parents, rides in patrol cars for intimidation, and unnecessary handcuffing. These are just some of the violations of the rights of Palestinian minors detained by the Israeli occupation forces in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Taken in for lengthy interrogation sessions without being given the opportunity to speak to a lawyer or their parents before the questioning begins. Palestinian kids are then held in detention facilities under harsh conditions for days and maybe weeks. To discuss this issue with us from Palestine, from the West Bank, is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Wahdan. Now, Palestinian minors from both eastern part of Jerusalem and the West Bank are being pulled out of bed in the middle of the night. They are being unnecessarily handcuffed. They are being dragged for interrogation, sometimes for days, sometimes for weeks, away from their parents and away from everything that they really know without the presence of lawyers. During the time of the incarceration, what options do their parents have to try and protect their children from all of this unnecessary terrorism?
Actually, the parents are forces. They can't actually do anything in front of this savage raids and incarcerations of minors. The parents try to defend their children while they are at home or in front of their homes, but after the soldier, the Israeli soldiers, take them away, they can do nothing except, you know, hiring lawyers or going to some human rights organizations to help them trace where their children are. So while in detention, they are kids are deprived totally from getting this legal assistance. Even the Red Cross sometimes takes them 1 to 2 weeks until they can meet their children. And during this time, the Israeli interrogators and the Israeli forces can do anything with them. They can intimidate them, they can threaten them, blackmail them, and the kids have actually no, except for the knowledge that they get from their peers, but they don't have the legal knowledge to defend themselves. Actually, they are being in this battle on their own while in prisons.
So you're telling me, Dr. Wahdan, that in 2020 you have people coming over to your house, kidnapping your child at the middle of the night, taking your minor for interrogation for God knows what, trying to embezzle them and trying to terrorize them to make them maybe sign some papers that would later on be used as an indictment against them. If this is happening in the world, any other place in the world, the entire globe would go crazy. Why is Israel allowed to get away with this violation of basic human rights?
Well, if we compare what happens in the U.S. during Trump, or even before that, what happens to minors and what happens to minorities and you know, people of color, and how the authorities are treating them, how the police forces are treating them, we can get the picture very clear here. They have a free hand. You know, the interrogators, the police forces, the soldiers here have a free hand because they have a cover-up. And who is covering up their, you know, their terrorizing and their criminal acts against Palestinian minors, women, old people? They have nothing, actually, to stop them because the U.S. is backing them up. And the rest of the NATO countries, the rest of the allied forces, which are led by the U.S., is defending them. The U.N., actually, and international human rights has piles of cases that shows and is a solid evidence of crimes that has been committed against minors, which do not get anywhere. All these reports, all these statistics that are sitting in the, you know, in the drawers and offices of the UN human rights offices do not get any legal, let's say, any legal follow-up in order to put an end to these violations of human rights and violations of international law. So Israel goes, you know, unpunished, unaccountable for all its crimes, killing youth, actually keeping the bodies of the martyrs of Palestinian children. Until now, we have like more than 50 bodies of children who have been martyred in 2015. And the families cannot get their, you know, their bodies to...
There are a lot of scandals affiliated with these cases, with a lot of them being organ trafficking by the Israeli entity. But these practices leave the occupation forces, as you said, free to pressure to the kids, the families, and to make them confess. And indeed, at some point, some kids actually sign involuntarily confessions, which are used basically. They are written in a different language than that they know, and they are obviously false ones, but the kids are intimidated to do so, which are then used as a basis of indictments against these kids, which could actually lead them to be behind bars for more than 20 years, according to the age of the kid. But why bear all this cost? I mean, they're definitely paying a lot of money to do this. Why are they bearing all this cost? I mean, what young kids are confessing to crimes that they have nothing to do with? What are the Israelis actually achieving by this specific act of intimidation and terrorism?
Actually, they want to terrorize and intimidate the kids so they don't throw stones. That's the major, you know, the major accusations that they use against these kids. Because what else do they have except for throwing stones at the soldiers when they, you know, when they barge in into their homes or into their villages or into their olive yard fields? That's the only thing that they have. They want to defend themselves from the assaults of these soldiers or settlers. In this case, it's during this last, you know, during this season of olive picking, so many people have been, you know, documented as being targeted by settlers and by soldiers. And hundreds of trees has been uprooted or burned while the people are trying to protect it. But of course, they can't do much. And confession by kids at during interrogations is very famous for the best, like, 4 or 5 decades. Mm-hmm. They try to use this to force kids because, of course, they want to close the case and send them to prison. But with throwing stones, no, I don't think that there is any charge in the whole world that puts kids behind bars for throwing a stone. But of course, they fabricate allegations and accusations against these, you know, peaceful kids who are trying to defend their olive fields or mm-hmm. trying to defend their fathers, while they the soldiers trying to arrest their fathers. So these criminal acts or actually war crimes and crimes against humanity that are committed by the Israelis are not being accountable and not being addressed by the ICC, for example. Mm-hmm. Because to go to this court, you need years and years, and with lots of evidence, especially with martyrs, for example. We, in our case, our foundation, Sheikh Hassan Foundation, has been following some cases of martyrdom or even severe wounds by the Israeli soldiers, and it doesn't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. It stays there.
It basically starts with the fact that Israel actually does not. It starts with the fact that Israel does not even recognize the ICC, for that matter, or any other international community, if you will, body, which I hate that word, by the way. It's just a couple of countries in the West deciding over what happens in our region, especially in occupied Palestine. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate, for speaking to us about the horrific incidents that the young people of Palestine, the youth of Palestine, is going through because of the Israeli occupation forces. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will talk about Lebanon. Now, as the efforts to form a Lebanese government headed by Saad al-Hariri falter, the media silence regarding the government formation directly and openly between the president of the country, Michel Aoun, and the prime minister-designate Saad al-Hariri has changed from a positive issue in terms of preventing confusions to a negative issue after several weeks had passed without any hopeful signs emerging as gossip, rumors and misinformation multiplied without any clarifications being issued by those involved in the pressing file of government formation. Hariri stuck in government formation in Lebanon in this following report. Lebanon is currently experiencing a gradual deterioration towards the abyss in light of its political stalemate, financial and economic hardships, and the lack of a support program from the international community as the required reforms have not yet been achieved. November 19 last week saw a sudden increase in the dollar exchange rate, which reached 8,200 Lebanese pounds on the black market before dropping slightly. The rate had dropped to under 7,000 Lebanese pounds less than a month ago when Saad al-Hariri was assigned to form a new government based on the French rescue initiative on October 22nd. However, that has yet to happen, with the efforts to form a Lebanese government headed by Saad al-Hariri faltered so far. Several factors have been influencing this trend. However, it is the external interference that is lock-jamming any political development in Lebanon, especially after the new U.S. sanctions imposed against the head of the Free Patriotic Movement, former Minister Gibran Basile, beginning with the continuous U.S. pressure on every prime minister designate so far to limit the representation of Hezbollah in the government formation process and to deny it ministerial positions despite the fact that Hezbollah has the majority in the Lebanese parliament. Add to that the external influence in the form of continuous Arab and Gulf messages to Hariri, making it clear to him that there will be no change in the currently adopted policy towards Lebanon, and therefore no aid unless there is a change in the Lebanese government's dealing with Arab and Persian Gulf files. Mind you, all the while, the international community is also warning that Lebanon will not receive any kind of aid and financial loans unless it forms a new government that is trusted internally and internationally and is particularly capable of launching the much-needed reform workshop on various levels. Faced with this reality, Prime Minister-designate Saad al-Hariri is between a rock and a hard place. He feels obliged to succumb to external pressure while the internal political demands puts the future of the entire country on the line. A decisive week ahead for Lebanese Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri, he either fails to form a government or he will form one that resembles its predecessors in both form and terms of power and lose all foreign support. Now with us to discuss this issue from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashebi, who is an academic and a writer. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nashebi. Now, observers of the Lebanese political dilemma believe that the external influence in the form of continuous U.S. pressure on Lebanon would be the main reason behind why Saad al-Hariri has failed so far to formulate a government, specifically as